Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Nothing about India is ever simple. The country is too big, too complex, too dynamic. That was certainly reflected in recent national elections. On the one hand, business as usual, in the sense that Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP party won a plurality, giving him an historic third term. On the other hand, the BJP lost its majority, required coalition partners to maintain control, and the opposition, including Rahul Gandhi and Congress, seemed to have new life as a serious political force. So which is it? Did Modi, denigrated by some as a Trump-like autocrat, or at least an illiberal Democrat, win or lose? Did the majority of Indian voters reject the Hindu nationalism that has been his trademark? Was this election about Modi, about economics, about something else, all of the above? And what happens next? So what? As always, more questions than answers, but my guest today can surely point us in the right direction. Vishakha Desai is an Asia scholar whose career has focused on art, culture, policy, and women's rights. Born in India, living in the United States, Vishakha moves seamlessly between the two countries and the two cultures. Welcome, Vishakha, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you, Alan. Delighted to be here.
Let's start at 50,000 feet. The Congress has been in decline since the mid-80s, BJP in ascendance since the mid-90s, more or less. I know it's way too early, but could this recent election have marked the beginning of the end of those trends?
As you pointed out, nothing in India is simple, and none of these answers to your questions will be simple, only because I think it is too soon to tell. It is clear that because the expectations were set so high that they were going to win absolute majority, that is the BJP, Bharatiya Janata Party, of Modi, and they did not win majority, is a big statement. However, you have to recognize that the combination of factors really made that possible. And it is very difficult to say that therefore it's one trend, that it is all about the decline of BJP, because it has to do with combination of factors. One is that Modi ran this in a presidential style election. The great leader, he was carrying the whole burden. The BJP was overconfident, as they were in 2004, when they lost the majority as well, and actually Congress came back to power. It also has to do with the fact that actually in a parliamentary system, as it is in India, they did not field strong local candidates. And 100 candidates that were actually newcomers, they came from other sections of the BJP, partly because they wanted to court those particular segments of the society. And what that meant was that you had weak local candidates, and you were counting on one sole national leader to carry you through. And they were going on and on about 400 par, meaning we're going to go way beyond the majority. And that created a problem for them because they did not pay enough attention to local issues, the local candidates. And that's where Rahul Gandhi and the coalition succeeded in having strong candidates at the local level. And that changes the picture.
Let's give our listeners some numbers. The lower house of the parliament has 543 seats. BJP won 240 and with allies secured something, I think, 293. Last time round, the outgoing Congress, outgoing parliament, had 303 seats, the BJP, and the coalition 353. So they lost 60 seats, more or less. But as you just pointed out, Modi wasn't campaigning for the status quo. He was campaigning, trying to sweep the board. He wanted at least 400 seats. The obvious question, and you just described some of the mistakes they made, but at the core of it, what did Modi get wrong? Is it about having the wrong candidates? Is India not want a presidential, de facto presidential system? Was he just too arrogant? Is this the usual comeuppance of someone who gets a little too full of themselves at some point?
I think, again, it's a combination. One was that the whole party thought it was all Modi all the time. Singular power. And that therefore they would make it because he's charismatic, which he is, and that he's going to carry it. The second thing was that it was also about the economy, stupid, which has to do with the fact that actually, while India is the fastest growing economy in a macro sense, it was not equally distributed. And therefore, it was really the secondary, tertiary cities where unemployment remains very high, especially for young people at 45%. Incredible, because they've not created enough jobs. That was, therefore, people are saying, wait a minute, you're telling me everything is fabulous, but I don't feel it. And so, therefore, it was the local issue combined with this focus on a national leader that actually created a weak link for them. That's one thing. The second thing is that the opposition united front, the India group, as it were, with Congress in the lead, they zero in on those economic issues. And therefore, they stayed local while Modi went global and national. And that's where there was a disjoint between where people were feeling their bread and butter issues and what they were trying to focus on at the national level.
Not to make this about the United States, but there is a famous American political saying, all politics is local. And I think that actually somewhat triumphs. It's the economy, stupid, or it's the combination of the two, which is what you just literally said.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that because there is, in fact, a pride, you have to recognize, in the way Modi has positioned India as a global player. And we can talk about that some more, the pros and cons of that. But there is a consistency on that issue. Congress Party, the India United Front, they actually agree on most of the foreign policy issues. There was no big gap between them. There was no big gap in terms of, okay, the growth is good, but in fact, what are you going to do at the local level? That's where the dissonance was. And the third dissonance was too far onto the communal divisive politics.
And that I want to come back to in a minute, but before we get there, because that is terribly important, but maybe put it differently. One way to get there is to talk about geography. And clearly a big part of what happened during the election was the shift in Uttar Pradesh, where essentially the BJP lost something like 30 seats in what was their stronghold. So half of the national loss is in one place.
Right. I think that actually, when you think about it, the real losses occur in three states. Maharashtra on the west, with Mumbai as the capital. Bengal, where communists have been strong and socialist parties have been strong, with Mamata Banerjee. And UP. UP was the most surprised because UP was their stronghold. And Uttar Pradesh is the North Indian state. If it was a state alone in the world, it would be the sixth largest country.
240 million people. It's mind-boggling.
And it is interesting that a lot of other states that are big, that have been divided in smaller groups, but not this particular state for all kinds of political reasons. So then this is also where the Hindu temple was actually built on, when they demolished the mosque and all of that controversy that flared up in 1993. And they made a huge deal about it. In that city alone, BJP lost. So what that tells you is that I do think that one has to take some comfort. It's not just economy, But there is something about going too far in one direction that people say, you know what? We don't want that. And I think there is something to be said about that. Also, the chief minister of that state is a Swami, ultra-Hindu guy. And this is a state where Samajwadi Party, which is in the coalition with Rahul Gandhi, actually came together and the younger leaders really worked hard. They fielded stronger candidates than BJP did in UP. The only thing that I think we have to be cautious about is not to make too big a generalization about how people are really feeling that we don't want all this communal politics, is the fact that this is also where they did not use, that is BJP, the Rashtriya Sevak Sangh, which is the RSS ultra-right-wing Hindu wing of the party, that actually is on the ground. They field workers, they bring the local people out, and all of that, they actually sidelined them this time around. So what it could mean is that if that ultra-right-wing on-the-ground network had been much more active, we don't know what would have happened. But it is true that at least what we know in Ayodhya, they lost. And Modi himself, who ran in Varanasi, which is the, you know, Banaras, the Hindu sort of spiritual center, last time around, when he ran from there, he won by 400,000 votes. This time, his majority went down to 150, give or take. So there is something about that issue, but I wouldn't put too much faith in only as if everybody has now negated the communitarian politics.
Well, and that is in some ways the real question. Like a football game, elections, some elections are won and some are lost. And that's, what is the dominant storyline? That's what we're really trying to parse here. Did Modi lose or did the opposition win? And specifically, did Hindu nationalism lose? You're saying maybe, maybe not, too early to tell, and it depends where you look. Or did people say, no, 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 it's about the, it is about economics. I saw this great quote from a woman in Ayodhya, in fact. Quote, politics based on religion is worthless. What we want is 24/7 electricity, enough water, and opportunities for our children. I mean, all it can be true at the same time, but is your sense net-net? And again, it's just the election is still fresh. Is your sense that Hindu nationalism is more in the rearview mirror than in front of us? Or is that struggle still likely to recur?
I think that that goes back to one of the, I would say, important strategy of BJP was to actually create three different strategies. One was at the top level, be favorable to industrialists in big urban centers. The second one was at the lowest of the lowest poor, deliver goods, which had been promised for many, many times. They actually created an amazing electronic kind of transfer, going money directly to people's bank accounts, so forth and so on. So those people were happy. The in-between people is where they tried to use the emotional valence of Hindu jingoistic nationalism. But that's a huge swath of people. And that is where people said, wait a minute, not so fast. I want to make sure that I have what I need. Exactly the Ayodhya quote that you made. And these are the people who are educated, but middle to lower middle class. And they're saying, I'm not seeing this. You're telling me fastest growing this and that. I'm not seeing this. And therefore, they are the ones who are saying not so fast. And that is a good sign in a way, because the coalition, the two coalition parties that are going to be part of the governing council, they, both of the leaders are seasoned politicians, and they are not as communitarian as BJP. So they, it will be in this arena that there might be a little bit of a kind of a barrier to pushing hard on the Hindu nationalism thing. And that, I think, is the silver lining of the coalition government. It's not so much in the foreign policy. Economically, I think they will come together, not a problem. It is this arena that actually he will have to be careful on.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Part of the reason, supposedly, that Modi wanted his 400 seats was to give him a supermajority in order to make constitutional changes. And we see that same story in a bunch of other countries right now.
Exactly, exactly.
So the constitutional change question, which we've not touched on yet, I have seen reporting that some early dicing and slicing of the numbers looks like he lost, the BJP lost votes with the Dalits, in part because they are protected in the Constitution, almost in a unique way globally. And supposedly, and I put this as a question, they felt that they might be at risk if this supermajority opened up the Constitution. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I think that why it makes sense is also what Modi is doing in forming the government. So in the states where he lost to Dalits, he is trying to get Dalit leaders into the government at the state minister level. In northeastern India, in other parts of India. And those are the states that have state elections coming up. So in a way, he is learning that lesson as that he lost that vote. And he's also trying to court Christians because these are some of the minorities, not Muslims, but is courting Christians. So I think that there is some lessons that they're learning about what to do with this. I do think that I'm not sure if the Dalits would have said, we don't want to give him absolute majority, because that's like a big national concept. But there were Dalit leaders who talked about that. And that is what made, in the opposition parties. So that's what made a difference. And I think that, so one has to recognize it is maybe not just the voters themselves, but how they understood what will happen. It's also the minorities, because the special compensation that was given to Dalits, which is a lower OBC, as sometimes they're called, and beyond, lower caste, that was all in the Constitution, and minorities and their rights. Between, among these groups, you create a kind of a feeling like, wait a minute, what's going to happen to me? And that does seem to have made a difference.
Made a difference in the sense that these questions of constitutional change are now off the table.
Exactly. At the moment, it looks like it, because I don't think that this coalition parties will actually go ahead with that.
You've already talked a bit about the so what? What are the consequences? And as I understand it, we've just said no constitutional change. Economics will get a little more subtle. It isn't just about the growth rate or the inflation rate. It's about my personal voter economics, what I'm seeing as an individual. So you got to focus on the micro, not the macro. And maybe, but huge question mark, somewhat blunted Hindu nationalism in terms of specific policies.
I agree with you very much. I mean, you should become an India specialist. It's pretty good.
I've learned from you, my dear.
Oh, no. I mean, I think that what is interesting about that is that I think that there will be some mediation in terms of what industrial policies get developed, because the focus on growth often came from other industries rather than low-level job-creating industries that India still does not have a strong manufacturing base. And you might say, well, you know, bypass the manufacturing because where we are with service and, you know, AI and so forth and so on. But the truth is, you need to create on a monthly basis more than 1 million jobs every month. That's how many young people are coming to the market. Where are these jobs going to come from? And not everybody's going to go in the informal sector. Not everybody can go into the government sector. These are sort of big places where people go. They want jobs. And there are none. And they're being trained in a way that actually doesn't allow them to get good jobs. Because even if you get a college graduate, most of the industry people would say, we have to retrain them. They are not ready. They're not industry ready. So Infosys, Mahindra, the board that I've sat on, they create their own university to train these people. So it takes another 2 years, you know. And that, I think, is a big, big problem for India between education and the job creation.
I very much want to switch to foreign policy. But before doing that, earlier you said something on the order of 45% of Indian youth, whatever that's defined as, are unemployed, which sounds impossible, or rather impossible to cope with, perhaps. So, and you've just spoken to it again. How can half of youth be unemployed? What do they do?
I mean, this is true in Africa. It's in so many places. The only thing I would say is that when they talk about unemployment and that number does not take into account the informal sector because you don't have any way to actually judge how many people are in that informal sector, meaning cash economy, things that are happening on the side. You know, all of that is also part and part of the problem. And so I probably there are people who make money, but they're not fully employed to the capacity that they could be employed. And so I think that one would have to parse that number out. But I do think it's a huge issue. And I do feel that without the education liberalization and change of what you teach people, and without industrial sector manufacturing jobs that require low-level skills, you're not going to get there. And in a way, you have to take a leaf from China and Southeast Asia. Why are you losing jobs? Manufacturing jobs that are leaving from China, they're going to Indonesia, Vietnam, Bangladesh. Why not India? Not enough. I mean, Apple is coming to India, but not those kinds of manufacturing jobs that you really need to create. And he is trying to, or was trying to, liberalize hiring and firing practices. But that also kind of backfired on them because a lot of workers thought that they would get fired. And, you know, so that creates another set of problem. But you need to create some ways to make it easy for industrial sector to produce more low-level jobs.
Let's talk briefly about foreign policy, which clearly was not a factor in the elections, it appears, nor is it in most countries a factor. We worry about it, but most voters don't worry about it. That said, India has played an interesting role in the BRICS over the last years. There's an effort to make it the fulcrum of the global South in opposition to the global North, the U.S. in particular, but the U.S. and Europe as well. I can't quite tell whether India has been and will be part of that. Let's try to move away from the North and deal, whether it be currency or trade or regulation or climate issues. We look at issues in a global South context led by the BRICS countries. Or whether they want to continue to play more in a globalized governance framework. Your sense?
I mean, I will say that Modi has been much more muscular in foreign policy. And by having Jaishankar, who is actually the foreign minister, right, external affairs minister, and reappointed, a seasoned diplomat, smart, was ambassador to China, ambassador to the U.S., and so not a dummy by a long shot. And therefore, it's not Modi completely dictating that. But the way they have developed the foreign policy is to play in multiple arenas. And that, I think, is very smart for them. So it used to be that they talked a lot about BRIC. Right now, Indian foreign policy is also focused very much on individual relationships. So they're very focused on the Middle East. Strong relationship with UAE, strong relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel. So that is making that move to the Middle East and the MENA region. Similarly, they're very active in the Quad, which is the US, Japan, Australia, and India coalition, naval power, moving in that direction precisely and explicitly as a bulwark against China, while continuing to soften the border issues, not resolved yet. But Jaishankar actually just was quoted as saying is that we want to make sure that that doesn't flare up, but we are going to play an important role in the Quad moving forward with that, and that those are also one of the most important relationships we have. They are also, believe it or not, a developing relationship with Taiwan. And so the Taiwan president was one of the first to congratulate Modi, and Modi responded. Now, usually you would get the congratulations, you wouldn't respond. And China has made a big deal that, you know, this is a rogue nation, it's in the inalienable part of mainland China. Modi has said nothing, but it has to do with Apple midwifing the relationship between Taiwan and India to create a manufacturing plant in India that would go away from or take away from some of the jobs in China. And so there's a strong relationship based on business to business that India is actually promoting. So what I'm saying is that it's no longer about the global north and global south. For India, they're playing, and climate, they're much more focused on how to do the work with solar energy that Modi talked about when actually for the Paris Agreement, and solar power in India is going like gangbusters. So they're also trying to create the electric battery producing plants in India. And so all by way of saying is that they will make the relationship where they think it's going to be useful to them. But Quad being one of the most important relationships that they're developing now. So, and that is very much not about global north and global south. So there's less conversation about BRIC right now in India.
Is there an effort to define and sustain a cold peace with China? They don't want war, as you said, obviously. They also don't want to join the U.S. side, air quotes on that. Is the third way, India always has a third way. Is the third way a cold peace of some kind?
Yeah, and I think also what it is going to be is as much as they don't want a very aggressive, negative relationship with China, they do want to contain China. And I think that's why Quad becomes an important part for them, to actually develop those kind of military, naval, other relationships, that, and then work with Southeast Asian nations so that there is some pushback to the Chinese relationship. But they won't do it the way America will do it, because it just doesn't work. I mean, same thing with Russia. You know, they're not going to give up on the Russian relationship. They managed to get an exception to get crude oil from Russia, even after Ukraine war. And they continue to do that.
It is remarkable. The U.S. does seem to insist it's either us or them, pick. And we've done that historically. It's not unique to this particular moment.
No, I mean, if you always do that.
The Chinese are much better at saying, yeah, we'll work with everybody. Taiwan happens to be a very particular issue. And it's fascinating that he's willing, Modi and colleagues are willing to play with the Taiwan issue. Because the Chinese don't allow a lot of maneuvering room.
And yet, when it comes to the economic relationship, they can't do anything about it. if Apple continues to work with Taiwan and India and moves the things, what are they going to do?
Well, same is true of chips. At the moment, chips go wherever they go.
Right.
And China needs Taiwan. We need Taiwan. We, the United States, need Taiwan. The Europeans need
India
Taiwan.
India needs Taiwan. Everybody needs Taiwan.
Right. And nobody wants to destroy it because it makes no sense. To destroy it would be the worst thing to do.
They've also created a way whereby Indian workers are going to go to Taiwan because of the labor shortage. And that's a big deal because that's a whole other kind of relationship.
Bottom line, the election, as you've described it, sure, it was there are surprises all over the place, but perhaps it's the best thing that could have happened to India because it puts it, you used the word moderating before, it puts it on a moderating path that threatened to get out of control. And the last thing you want to do in India, historically, we know this, is go way too far in one direction. So perhaps this was the right election at the right time for India.
I also think that just to remember that actually Modi still has a lot of popularity. And so one must not underestimate that. And if they got 240 plus seats, it has to do with him. But this will be most likely his last election.
Well, he's been in office for 10 years and now he's got another X, whatever X might be. That's a long time to run anything as big and complex as India.
5 years. And so it's most likely that it will be the last. And I think that therefore, what happens in the next 5 years becomes very important. And what direction they take in, too soon to tell. But the way he's made the appointments for the cabinet, major cabinets are all staying with BJP. Folks are coming back. The portfolio they had, they're taking it again. So the coalition parties have not gotten any of those big positions. But they're getting lots of things in the secondary positions. And then the question is, how are they going to wield their power in Lok Sabha, in the parliament?
At the start of our conversation, Vishak, I suggested there might be more questions than answers. You just added some more questions. But thank you very much for this conversation. I at least am smarter than I was at the start. You know India quite well, and thank you for sharing.
My pleasure, and what a delight it is to actually have a conversation. You did your homework well. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.